Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. So today I'm very happy to have Dr. John Horgan on the line with us, and he is a professor, psychologist, terrorism researcher, and the director of University of Massachusetts Lowell's Center for Terrorism and Security Studies. So thank you, first of all, for coming on the show, Dr. Horgan.
It's absolutely my pleasure, Chelsea. I'm a huge fan of the Loopcast, so thanks so much for having me on.
And thank you for being a fan. That's fantastic. So today we are going to talk about terrorism behavior, and there's a lot that falls underneath that, so it will be a nice, varied, interesting talk. Why don't we start out with the psychology in general behind terrorism?
Sure. Well, I often, you know, try to start by defining psychology to my students. I mean, psychology, very simply, is the scientific study of human behavior and mental life. I mean, in a nutshell, it's about why we do what we do, how we do it, and so forth. I think there are probably at least two defining characteristics of a psychological approach to something. And the first one is that, well, we typically tend to look at the individual level of analysis, so people essentially, single individuals or small groups. And the second issue is that methodology defines psychology. It's one of the cornerstones of anything to do with deciphering, uncovering, unraveling, I suppose, the mystery of human behavior. You can believe whatever you want to believe about why we do things, but the only thing that will settle a dispute between you and me is evidence through methods.
And looking at that with methodology defining psychology, when you're looking at terrorism, how do you go about that? What type of methodology do you use to define the psychology behind terrorism?
Well, the psychology of terrorism, I suppose there are a number of avenues or outlets, I mean, or expressions for that. For the most part, psychologists have affects us in the short term, in the immediate aftermath of a terrorist event, the drama, the anxiety that surrounds that. Surprisingly, there hasn't been a significant amount of research on, I suppose, the psychology of the terrorist, the person who becomes involved in terrorism and engages in terrorist acts. We've seen some research in the 1970s, some in the 1980s, and then we've seen a slight increase throughout the 90s and early 2000s. For the most part, that research has indirectly tapped into terrorist motivation, things that we call the radicalization process, through basically analyzing what terrorists say about themselves, what they say about other people. And from a methodological perspective, we have analyzed statements, public statements, private statements, autobiographies, all of the kinds of ways in which we might get insights into why it is that people seek to join these movements. And that's probably been the main emphasis in terms of psychological research on the terrorist. It has to do with issues to do with becoming involved in terrorism, the hows and the whys.
A common thing that you tend to hear from a general person when you discuss terrorism or there's a terrorist attack and it's in the news is this idea that terrorists are psychologically abnormal or insane, crazy. Is that a myth?
I think it's not a myth. I mean, I think what is unhelpful is the idea that mental illness can somehow help us explain terrorism. I think it can't. It would be misleading to say that there are no mentally ill people involved in terrorist activity. I mean, there clearly are. I mean, it's just the law of averages. You're bound to get some individuals who suffer from mental illness. You're certainly bound to get, in some of the bigger movements, like we're seeing with ISIL, for instance, you're bound to have at least some element of psychopathy. But for the most part, I think mental illness is a very poor explanatory factor in terms of how and why people become involved in terrorism. We increasingly we're seeing that mental illness is something that is very often a consequence of having spent time in a terrorist movement. People become very deeply affected by prolonged life in a terrorist movement.
And on that point, is it similar to, say, soldiers that have gone off to war? So, for instance, we have a lot of soldiers returning from Afghanistan and Iraq, and we have this PTSD. Is it on a similar level that you experienced these horrific instances?
I think that's a fair analogy. I mean, I wouldn't see any good reason to see why that wouldn't be the case. I mean, there have been no studies, to my knowledge, identifying PTSD in a sample of former terrorists, but. I can, like many of my colleagues, can tell you anecdotally that many of the people whom we've been fortunate to access and speak to about their experiences in terrorism do suffer as a result. They suffer during their time as active terrorists, and they also suffer when they try to disengage, or when they have rather disengaged from the group. So mental illness and terrorism are, I think, related in ways that are a bit more complex than we've been giving them credit for. But for the most part, you know, for about the first 15, 20 years of terrorism, I think the whole area has been, in the words of my colleague Andrew Silk, he said that it's been tainted by this aura of pathology that really has not been very helpful in terms of helping us understand who becomes a terrorist and why.
And on that point, again, there's another thing that you tend to hear in a lot of articles in the media, let's put it that way, that there's this assumption that terrorists are morally disengaged from society. In cases that you looked at, is this something that you're seeing? Is it something you're not? What are your thoughts on this?
That's a really interesting question. Moral disengagement is a tricky one. Certainly, in a lot of the psychological analyses I've seen, and in a lot of accounts of former terrorists, I often see terrorists very, very regularly referring to answering their conscience. You know, they say that, well, their decision to take up arms basically reflects a moral or political awakening. I was blind and now I see. I was asleep, now I'm awake. They very much see it as their duty to take up arms in defense of those who can't help themselves. I've often thought that, you know, in order to be an effective terrorist, you have to be able to suppress morality. You have to be able to suppress doubt and to suppress guilt. And there are lots of ways in which active terrorists do that. You certainly have to be very good at shifting responsibility for what you do as a terrorist. And there is a certain element of moral disengagement in this. One of the things that we learned from some of the very early research on social psychology, especially you might be familiar with the famous Milgram experiments, where he had electric shocks being delivered to students, was that the so-called teachers, the people who thought they were giving electric shocks, in reality they weren't, they would very, very quickly accept a sort of subordinate role whenever they would start to experience discomfort. So in other words, they would pull out of the experiment much earlier when the real authority figure wasn't around. And we very much see those kinds of dynamics being played out in terrorist movements as well. One of the most striking examples of that I've seen in the last few years was during the Mumbai siege. It's one of the few terrorist attacks where we actually have access to the timeline and the transcripts of communications, where the leaders are nudging the attackers all the time to focus on the minutiae of what they're doing. They're saying, you know, no, don't digress from what you're doing. Don't lose focus. Keep the attention. Keep the attention here. Keep the attention there. And essentially, moral disengagement being played out in real time. It was astonishing.
That must be very interesting to look at, actually. So, why don't we look at this idea of the drive to terrorism? So,
sure,
we're hearing a lot about this right now with these young individuals that are getting compelled to travel to Syria and be a part of the Islamic State and ISIS. So, I mean, as you mentioned, and as a lot of literature on this topic has mentioned, it's really hard to pinpoint why an individual will become a terrorist.
Sure.
Because everybody has their different reasons for going off and joining a fight or the jihad, so to speak. But in the cases you've worked on, what are some of the motivations that you've come across?
Oh, gosh, happy to talk about that issue. I think to pick up on something you said, though, I mean, you know, you're right. It's very difficult to do valid and reliable research on these issues. But the main reason I think we don't know enough about terrorist motivation is that I don't think the science is there yet. You know, we talk about issues to do with terrorist psychology or the psychology of terrorism, whatever we call it, but there are still very, very few people doing research on this, and there are all kinds of reasons for that. But to answer your question, I think the motivational spectrum is probably the same across the world, and no matter what terrorist movement we're looking at, it's diverse in the sense that there are always going to be lots of different factors at play. It's complicated, or complex rather, in the sense that the unique combination of factors is going to change from person to person, and it's probably going to change within the same person over time. But to me, I think there's two sets of issues here. The first is that, you know, we have a laundry list of things that we might refer to as risk factors or push and pull factors, in the words of some analysts. And these are, you know, these will be very familiar to you, the kinds of things you'll see in media accounts all the time. Adventurism, excitement, camaraderie, belonging, a sense of duty, a sense of outrage, and closely related to that, the idea of wanting to get revenge. Altruism, disillusionment, humiliation. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. Those kinds of things will inevitably, I suppose, vary from person to person. But like I said, they don't tend to be validated. We just don't have the studies to be able to say with certainty that we're more likely to see these risk factors for these kinds of groups versus others. The second issue, though, and it's something I think we've seen a lot more interesting research done on, is qualities of the process that they experience, you know, in being radicalized, in being recruited to these movements. We certainly see some more meaningful common denominators there. So there is a fiercely common thread certainly in foreign fighters right now, where there is this compulsion to act, to do something rather than just talk about it. And you know, we can explain that through any number of lenses, but helping fellow Muslims in need is a very common theme. I think it was Tom Heghammer, who had this lovely description one time. He said, you know, foreign fighters basically see themselves as aid workers with Kalashnikovs. And that sort of image really resonated with me. And then there's almost like a millenarian quality here whereby foreign fighters are encouraged to act now before it's too late. So there are all kinds of qualities that are associated with the process there. And the reason I think it's important to look at the process as opposed to, you know, individual risk factors is that what happens when people become involved in terrorism is that a lot of the individual differences, the idiosyncrasies, they tend to get flattened out the more time you spend in one of these groups. So, you know, some pretty diverse people eventually will start to speak the same language. They'll start to behave in the same ways, engage in the same kinds of rituals. So essentially, the more time you spend in one of these groups, the more essentially the group changes you. And that's basic social psychology, being played out here.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, you do see this camaraderie type of feeling and accounts when you look especially at foreign fighters going to Syria and some of these young people that are speaking of their motivations of why they have gone over.
Hugely so, and you know, we certainly have no shortage of access to some of those accounts, but we're only ever really getting just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, you know, it's almost cliche to say this as a psychologist, but motivation is a very, very, very complicated issue. And these kinds of risk factors, these common themes, I mean, they will vary even for the same person across time.
Another common thing that I've heard in cases, not just with Syria, of course, but a broad spectrum, is this idea of the drive to terrorism stemming from frustration in a person's life. So not finding roots within their social progress, education, jobs, career-wise, social environment, not fitting in with their social environment. And then there's this idea of, especially in the UK, the idea of second-generation UK citizens, but maybe their family came from Bangladesh or Pakistan, and therefore they don't quite fit into their family's social mindset, social drive, and they don't always fit in with the general young UK society as well. And so they tend to get more radicalized with religion, like they'll wear much more conservative clothes compared to their parents. So how much of this has become a factor in this drive to terrorism that maybe you've seen in cases that you've studied?
I think it's very relevant. I mean, it's certainly relevant right now in cases of us trying to understand why there might be differential rates of radicalization and recruitment, you know, with respect to the foreign fighter phenomenon. But something that I've seen across some of the cases I've studied have been this idea of second generation or third generation, whether it is a British-based second generation Pakistani kid who's being encouraged to go off to Pakistan or Afghanistan, or even, surprisingly, even an Irish Republican that grows up in the south of Ireland but is being sort of lured to the north of the country to have taken part in the conflict there. There is this... I think one of the terrorists I once interviewed described it as a dynamite mix, where you are second or third generation and you are being told by a recruiter that you are a conquered people, and it provides an impetus for you to go and act and to essentially fulfill what, you know, in a different context we would refer to as the neglected duty. And it is a very, very, very common thread that I see in very different kinds of groups as well.
And sort of building on that point, which, as you said, with the IRA case, how does displacement of aggression factor all into all of this? So right now we're seeing it more as this idea of East versus West, not Christianity, but the Western world against Islam. But as you said with the case, the Irish case, that could kind of play into it as well. So how much does this factor into the drive to terrorism?
Well, in a way, it's almost like the issue of you know, feeling displaced and feeling alienated and feeling conquered. An effective terrorist recruiter will be able to harness that disenfranchisement and will be able to not only convince the potential recruit of the need to act, but also the need to act with violence, that this is the only response, that this is not just the only response, but it is a defensive move against the forces of evil. So it very much features in the kinds of narratives we've seen used by recruiters, for sure.
And then looking at the idea of the justification of the act of terrorism, what are the ideas in the minds of terrorists that you have studied and interviewed of the morality, the justification behind doing acts of terrorism? What have you come across?
Great question. I think in some ways it goes back to that issue you asked me about earlier about moral disengagement. You know, Albert Bandura very often made the point that if you want to understand moral disengagement and if you want to understand the justification of these kinds of activities, you have to pay attention to language. Now Bandura looked at that in the context of dehumanization, but I really started to pay attention to this as a psychologist when I was looking at some of the Al-Qaeda documents that came out around about, I think it was 2003, 2004, and they are whether or not this is true, I don't know, but they are at least attributed to Saif al-Adel, the former Egyptian special forces officer who became involved with Al-Qaeda. And there was a wonderful series of documents where the author, whether it was Al Adil or somebody else, made the point in appealing to the Al-Qaeda membership. He said, and if I can remember the quote, he said, "We differ completely from our enemy in the psychological fight." And he basically said that, you know, we don't suffer as much psychologically in this because we don't make it mandatory for people to join the military. We don't make it mandatory for people to have to come and fight. So he's basically drawing on this relative position between our motivation and their motivation. And he talked about the difference between what it meant to be, what he called the true motivation of the mujahideen and their ability to handle these very, very, very difficult tasks. We often see as well a common theme in especially when terrorists themselves talk to us about, you know, how they basically cope with what they do. They engage in neutralization techniques. So they will deny responsibility. They will denigrate the victim. What one researcher said was, they'll condemn the condemners. They'll basically say, well, you know, how dare you condemn this for us when you yourselves are responsible for something far worse. And they'll also, a typical neutralization technique you'll hear is they'll also appeal to a higher loyalty. So they'll talk about the obligation to engage in this kind of an act, whether it is violent jihad or something else. So it's a very long-winded answer to your question, but there are certainly identifiable patterns behind the way in which people respond to these sorts of questions, for sure.
And at the starting of the talk, you did mention that you've interviewed past individuals that have been involved in terrorism in groups, and that mm-hmm. they've had a really hard time coping with acts that they've either witnessed or potentially done.
Some of them have. I mean, quite a few have had great difficulty in coping with the reality, and I suppose the reality of reintegration, the reality of being away from the group, and the reality of looking back at a history of violence that is, now unjustifiable to them. But there are others as well. I mean, I've certainly interviewed my fair share of ex-terrorists and would-be active terrorists who seem perfectly comfortable with what they've done.
And so this idea that you mentioned, the factors that help validate acts of terrorism, the different mechanisms to validate mm-hmm. it to both the world and the terrorists themselves, looking at it, I guess, in a sense, if you're very... a person that can very much cut off your feelings, maybe it might work. But on the other hand, is it almost just a way of talking yourself into it, so to speak? So
That's a nice way of describing it. It is about allowing yourself to become, social psychologists might use the word de-individuated. You allow the group to take over. You allow any doubts you might have about doing this act to be essentially sublimated within the group. It is the group that accepts responsibility for what it is you do. So that's very, very common for sure. And some people find it very difficult. You know, you talked at the very beginning about some of the myths. It is a myth that terrorists do not feel guilt for what they do. I can tell you they most certainly do, but some are better at suppressing that guilt than others.
So to me, it sounds like it really is an individual factor, that each person individually has a way of dealing with it, or maybe not dealing with it so well.
Certainly, yeah. And some deal with it by... getting drunk. Some deal with it by smoking drugs. Some deal with it by further immersing themselves in the ideology. Some deal with it by basically saying to senior figures, look, I don't really know what I've bought into here. And they're not trying to get out of the group, but they are trying to shift to another role within the movement that they might be more suited to. I've certainly spoken to a number of individuals who made it very, very clear that they were deeply committed to the movement, but that frontline activity, engaging in up close and personal aggression just wasn't for them.
Then another thing that you do hear within the media or people that are asking questions, especially with everything that's once again taking place in Syria and Iraq, is this factor of religion. And many terrorist movements in the past have also had a religious aspect to them. I mean, how much can we look at religion and the ideology behind the group and what they're portraying their religion as a major factor for the psychology of that group and the individuals that are a part of it?
It's a good question. I think it's certainly relevant. I mean, I think they're very deeply polarized discussions about, you know, whether or not this is a religious phenomenon or it is or it's not. And that discussion tends to be very much polarized. There's no question that religious ideology is drawn on as a justification. What we're less clear about is the role of religious ideology as a motivating factor. There are some who clearly are exposed to certain religious ideological content that is used very, very cleverly and very efficiently by recruiters to basically mobilize someone that would otherwise just be radical and wouldn't necessarily engage in terrorism. But for others who initially might become involved in a group through thrill-seeking or adventurism or just wanting to engage in what they view as essentially a humanitarian act, altruism in their eyes, religious content might become, it might become relevant for them only after the fact. We very, very often see that. People who aren't necessarily religious when they become involved in the group, well, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months down the road, they start to spew religious content. Very often it's typically cliched, it's parroted, it's not really understood on a deep level. But it's certainly used as something quite empowering to sustain their involvement, to sustain their commitment. After the thing that we don't really understand well is the behavioral sequencing here. So do people first of all become religious and then seek out involvement in terrorism? Do they, or is it the other way around? We haven't quite figured that out yet. But I think it's very, very important to see religion here as just one other kind of ideology.
Very much so. And then going back to, you alluded to the foreign fighter, which has been an interesting topic that has been quite relevant lately again. You know, we hear about foreign fighters going to Syria. And how much of that in your research have you seen this phenomenon of foreign fighters attached and involved in other terrorist groups and terrorist organizations? And of course, you know, everyone will think of Afghanistan, but
yeah,
past Afghanistan. So I know you did a lot of work with Ireland and the IRA. Did you see anything like this phenomenon happen with the IRA or Sri Lanka, Tamil Tigers? I mean, there's a numerous amount of groups, but do you see a connection?
It's a great question. I think certainly no connection in terms of the scale of what we're witnessing now. Although if you really want a sort of an historical parallel here, I mean, you've got to go back to the international brigades. I mean, you know, the numbers there far exceeded even what we're seeing with ISIS right now. But no question. I mean, when I first started doing research on terrorism and I did my PhD in Ireland, I was interviewing a lot of IRA members who were, you know, they grew up in the south of Ireland, and you know, Ireland is a tiny, tiny country. But you know, to grow up in the south of Ireland meant that, mentally speaking, you were a million miles removed from the troubles in the north. And the IRA recruited a lot of people from the south who had no real experience of what it meant to live in a deeply divided sectarian society. And so I was interviewing these guys and asking them about, you know, trying to tap into their motivation. And they said, you know, they were brought up on tales of, you know, adventurous fights against the British and you know, running gun battles across beautiful hedgerows and this kind of nonsense. When they got there and they realized that a lot of people were becoming involved for purely sectarian reasons, that this was a very ugly conflict, they started to become disillusioned because it didn't fit with their fantasy about what it meant to be involved. Now, the question that I've only relatively recently started to explore is whether or not those kinds of dynamics may or may not be similar to what today we would describe as a foreign fighter, as the foreign fighter phenomenon. It might seem a very odd kind of thing to make that parallel, but certainly the juxtaposition between the fantasy and the reality is very striking in both cases. And I've seen the same thing play out in some, like I said, second generation British Pakistanis who went to Afghanistan via Pakistan, and they thought, you know, this is not quite what I signed up for. So whether they would be examples of foreign fighters, I'm sure some would agree and others might disagree, but certainly in terms of the dynamics and the effects, lots and lots of similarities.
I think a perfect way to take the talk to another topic that I know you've worked extremely hard in this subject is disengagement and de-radicalization, which are very important in this talk because they're a whole nother part of psychology and terrorism.
Sure.
So briefly, why don't you, just to start off with, give our listeners a look at what these terms basically mean. So they're purely basic meanings of disengagement and de-radicalization in this context.
Absolutely. So very basically, disengagement means stopping terrorist activity. De-radicalization implies one unlearns certain attitudes and certain beliefs that we assume are conducive to engagement in terrorism. The other meaning attributed to de-radicalization is that it's quite a misleading collective term used to describe a variety of initiatives aimed at reducing the risk of re-engagement in terrorism. De-radicalization is synonymous with a number of very high-profile programs that have aimed at that were aimed at essentially trying to change the minds of terrorist prisoners under the assumption that if we change the way they think, that in turn reduces the risk of them re-engaging in terrorist activity.
And why don't we discuss what is being done to disengage and de-radicalize fighters? So you've alluded to certain programs. How many programs are there? I've heard that there are not enough and that we need to build more here in the States and overseas, and you hear different governments alluding to this idea. But what is being done at the moment, and what has been done in the past, and have there been successes in this subject?
I don't think anybody really knows how many programs there are. I once asked just about 3 or 4 months ago how many CVE programs there are, and the person to whom I was asking the question just laughed me out of the room. She didn't know, and nobody knew in her organization. There are lots and lots of de-radicalization programs ongoing around the world right now. Some of them are quite big. Some of them are quite well resourced. I suppose the Saudi rehabilitation program would be the best known of these, and others are tiny. They're being done on a shoestring budget, and they are being done without the intention of necessarily exposing themselves to the broader world. In fact, the Saudi program, which is, you know, now I think unfairly held up in the West as sort of the poster child for DRAD programs, that in itself was never intended to be made public. But I think they were so confident of their own successes in the past that they decided to try to convey that they had a template for success here. Lots of different kinds of initiatives, lots of different ways in which this cottage industry of programs is trying to prevent re-engagement in terrorism. Only some of those programs are actually drawing on the idea of de-radicalization. And ironically, some of the most effective programs I've seen really don't bother with de-radicalization. They don't waste their time trying to change people's views, change people's attitudes, nor do they waste their time trying to evaluate if that change has actually taken place. They're far more focused on the challenge of reintegration than de-radicalization per se. And I suppose the reason I started to look at these terms, you know, it's not just because I'm an academic and that's the kind of thing we do, but because I was finding that a lot of people disengage from terrorism without necessarily needing to de-radicalize. And in places like Pakistan and elsewhere, I'm seeing a lot of people disengage from the Pakistani Taliban and other militant movements in that region. And de-radicalization per se doesn't even feature into what these programs are doing. And yet, at the same time, these programs are very effective in preventing and minimizing, rather, the risk of these adolescents and young men re-engaging in terrorism.
And looking at these programs then, so if they're not necessarily trying to de-radicalize and change someone's beliefs and views, mm-hmm. is this disengagement and initiating them back into society and life of wherever their home country is or wherever they've landed, so to speak, is that just right there a way that slowly as they integrate into their surroundings, they start to de-radicalize on their own? Has that happened?
That is the, I think that's a working assumption, which is about, you know, it's, so some of the most effective programs I've seen are, they certainly, I mean, you know, they're not naive. I mean, they're certainly a very strong aftercare, post-release monitoring activity that goes on. But it is about providing people with the necessary skills, resources, and social networks to basically enable them to reintegrate into society. And it's about ensuring that there are enough protective factors there to protect them from victimization from a number of different interestingly enough, I was speaking to somebody earlier on today about this, a journalist, and we were comparing the foreign fighter phenomenon and how we might prepare for the challenge of reintegration there. There are parallels even back as far as the international brigades of the early 1920s, where a lot of those guys faced the same kinds of challenges. There certainly was nothing that could be said to be similar to an effort to de-radicalize them, but there were huge challenges with respect to what proper, meaningful reintegration meant. And I really don't think we've had that discussion to any great extent in the West. There's some really, really interesting programs ongoing in Europe right now, especially in Denmark, where they take a very, very pragmatic view about the fact that, you know, hey, at least in the first wave of foreign fighters that have gone out, it is very plausible that disillusionment can be genuinely detected and genuinely assessed, and that can lead to thrown in prison for the rest of their life.
So looking at this idea of de-radicalization programs, I'm sure there's a lot of people that are skeptical of this idea of bringing, say, foreign fighters from Syria that have done violent acts back to their home countries with the idea of de-radicalizing them and then letting them back into society. So looking at that, what type of opinions do you have for these skeptics? What type of advice?
I would say embrace your skepticism. I mean, I would be terribly skeptical of these efforts as well. At the same time, however, I mean, I would be one of the greatest champions for genuine efforts at reducing the risk of re-engagement in terrorism. I'm reluctant to use the term de-radicalization because I think that de-radicalization is a fool's errand. I think it really is just smoke and mirrors for the most part. I think one of the first things we have to start appreciating is that not all terrorists are created equal. We have dreamers, we have fantasists, we have people who went out there motivated by genuine humanitarian concerns and were essentially hoodwinked and fooled into engaging with ISIS. That said, there are also people who want to go to Syria because they want to cut people's heads off. I mean, you know, ISIS is nothing if not an equal opportunities terrorist movement. But with respect to preparing for potential returnees, we have to start serious discussions now about how we engage in effective terrorist risk assessment. And we have to ask questions like, well, you know, how much risk are we actually willing to tolerate? are you know, we have some risk standards in some areas, but in terrorism, it's very, very difficult to see that even the smallest degree of risk is seen as tolerable. This is very often why, you know, when you look at critiques of de-radicalization programs, and even the ones that point to allegedly 80, 90, 95% success rates, you only have to have one high-profile event for a program to essentially be labeled as a failure. But I think we know very, very little about what it means to engage in risk assessment of terrorists.
Looking at these programs, I would think there'd be a huge legal aspect. I'm sure every country, they all have, of course, their own legal systems. But say looking at the legal aspect of de-radicalization programs here in the States, I mean, there must be a lot of obstacles for people involved in these programs.
Well, there are, but I mean, in certainly in places like Saudi and in Yemen to a lesser extent, but Pakistan, Singapore, Indonesia, these programs take place within custodial settings, so prisons essentially. Surprisingly, there are few real obligations to participate in the programs, but there would be profound legal issues around them, of course. But again, it all goes back to even just asking the question, well, what, you know, when we talk about risk and risk of reengaging or risk of being released from prison and doing something, well, what are we talking about? I mean, you know, terrorism isn't one specific behavior. It's a multiplicity of different things. So if a former, does that constitute recidivism? Well, and on one level maybe, but on another level clearly not. But there are issues around severity, frequency, imminence. You know, how soon might we think there is a risk of them reengaging in something? Today, tomorrow, next year, 10 years from now? We haven't even begun to ask these questions.
And then looking at, once again, on this topic of programs set up for, let's call them returnees if we're using the Syrian example.
Sure.
How can these returnees help disenfranchise and fight ISIS's message by being involved in these de-radicalization programs? And as you mentioned, there's accounts of young individuals that have gone, signed up, you know, what the reality is is not what they signed up for, so to speak. And so how can they be brought back to their home countries and used to help disenfranchise this message and the media that the Islamic State is promoting at the moment?
Well, I think the first challenge falls on us to screen out the insincere returnees from those that are sincerely disillusioned. I think it's going to be increasingly difficult for a foreign fighter to claim that he or she is increasingly disillusioned with what ISIS is putting out there, because, you know, now, I mean, ISIS is, we all know what they're doing. We all know what they are about. We all know what their nature is. I think we need to do a far better job at providing a space whereby returnees or formers can essentially help delegitimize the efforts that ISIS recruiters are using either in the online space or in real life to pull people in. It is essentially about returning, but with better 4 or 5 years about counter narratives. But it goes way beyond this sort of this naive war of ideas type stuff. And certainly the religious arguments we will lose every single time. But it is about, it's about exposing hypocrisy. It's about exposing lies. It's about exposing the unpleasantness of it. And it's not about trying to delegitimize the very real grievances people have. I think that's the key message that seems to be missed time and time again.
To bring this talk to a close, we always like to give our guests a moment to maybe touch upon something that we haven't touched upon in the talk, or if there's a final statement you'd like to provide. So I'd like to open the floor to you.
Oh, gosh, thank you. I don't know, really. I started this, I think one of the first answers I gave you was almost not quite an apology, but to say that the science isn't there, and I keep saying this. We are, you know, Mark Sageman two or three years ago memorably said that the terrorism research has become just stagnant. And I think he's dead wrong in many ways, but he has a point in the sense that we seem to be circling around again and again and again to the same kinds of issues, the same kinds of problems, and we keep bemoaning the fact that we just don't have enough evidence. My real fear with respect to terrorist psychology is that we could leave this area, or I could leave this area, and come back in 10 years and we still wouldn't have any better answers to these questions. There are so few people doing research in terrorist psychology. We really need to do a far better job of essentially, you know, grooming our own next generation of scholars here. And so I don't want to end on a pessimistic note, but to say that it's something that's very important to me, and hopefully our science will improve.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time and your wonderful knowledge on this topic and for coming on the show.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.